So how often during the day do you find yourself worrying about Fidel Castro?
How are you, Fidel? Very well. Thank you. And you? Very well. How are you, Fidel? How are you, Fidel?
Well, during his sometimes eight-hour TV show, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez can barely get through a sentence without referencing the Cuban leader. The Revolutionary Without a Revolution, The Hugo Chavez Show. It's on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, November 25th. Adora Udoji is away. We're going to talk about stimulus packages here and abroad. We're also going to talk about guns and political hot button issues, as President Barack Obama could have a big impact, or should he just stay away from all the hot buttons? Those stories and more. But first, we have some headlines. If you're looking for credit, you may soon be tied up with the federal government. Later this morning, the Treasury and the Federal Reserve are set to launch a plan to get into the consumer loan game. The feds want to help the market for credit cards, car loans, and student loans. The government will lay out tens of billions of dollars to make it easier for regular consumers like you and me to get loans. Speaking of loans, Pakistan is now approved for a multi-billion dollar loan from the International Monetary Fund. Story may not grab you, but think twice. Pakistan's economy is struggling, and if the government there collapses, there's no telling what happens to the nuclear bombs in the arsenal. That from our paranoid news writer, Mark Garrison. And we don't have to remind you of all the terrorists who would love a few nukes in their equipment. Mark, just settle down, okay? I think we're fine with Pakistan. President-elect Barack Obama will elaborate on his economic plans today. Yesterday, he introduced a new Treasury Secretary and a slate of financial advisors. He's eager to be seen as working hard and fast on the economic crisis.
If we do not act swiftly and boldly, most experts now believe that we could lose millions of jobs next year.
Femi Okay is here. Mark's a little worried about Pakistan out there. Is he all right?
It's an important country to the United States.
All right, you're right.
It should be top of the newscast. Good morning to you all. President Bush says that he's working with President-elect Obama on some major economic moves.
I told the American people, and I told the President-elect when I first met him, that any time we were to make a big decision during this transition, he will be informed.
And the President-elect Obama takes over the White House on January the 20th. Investors apparently appreciate something in all of this. The Dow went up nearly 5% yesterday. That's after big gains Friday. Citigroup shares also rallied on news that the government would help the troubled financial firm.
Citigroup was up more than 50% yesterday.
That's an amazing improvement. Yeah. And the Asian markets closed up today right across the board. And we're also watching for new GDP and consumer confidence numbers. Both come out later this morning. And Osama bin Laden's former driver will move from Guantanamo Bay to his home country of Yemen. That's where he will serve out the remainder of his sentence. He spent 7 years at Guantanamo.
Thank you, Femi. And we are talking about annoying words. If you want to improve the English language, what would you do?
It's a no-brainer. It's a no-brainer, as if this is a good thing, that no thought is required, and you never hear the opposite. No one ever says, well, yeah, it's quite a brainer, isn't it, this difficult decisions.
Call us with your no-brainer at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. It's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it. Cleaning up the English language on The Takeaway.
How are you, Fidel?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The industrial nations of the world seem to be embracing stimulus packages of one kind or another as a way of restarting their economies. And we begin with the economy this morning. And down in Washington, it was a bit of an economic casting call as Barack Obama announced his senior economic advisors and laid out his priorities for his economic policy.
The way to think about it is short term, we've got to focus on boosting the economy and creating 2.5 million jobs. But part and parcel of that is a plan for a sustainable fiscal situation long term. And that's going to require some reforms in Washington.
Real reforms in Washington, jumpstarting the economy with 2.5 million jobs right away. Is that a realistic stimulus package? The markets are certainly reacting to the personnel that Barack Obama has named, including Timothy Geithner, who is the designate for the Treasury Department. But how realistic is all this? Joining us to talk about it is Jim Ellis, Assistant Managing Editor at Business Week. We also invited Jim to talk about this new cast of characters who are going to be advising the new president. Jim, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
First of all, we've heard $700 billion, $800 billion in the discussion of the financial rescue package. And in that case, you know, you're pumping money into the economy, and the metaphor sort of works there. But when you're talking about a stimulus package on the order of, some Democrats were saying, $700 billion, 5% of GDP, that is a more targeted and nuanced kind of program, and it also doesn't work very short term. Do you see a short term stimulus package in anything that's been discussed so far?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, we're basically going to see a jobs program. There's no question of that. I mean, when it happens, it's going to probably be through infrastructure spending, which has a pretty good multiplier effect. I mean, it throws a fair bit of money immediately into things like construction equipment, construction workers' salaries, and more importantly, all the materials that you use for roads and bridges and things like that. So it's a fairly traditional way to pump money in fairly quickly and to get it to people as opposed to programs that take a long time to get going. The problem, of course, is that it's a fairly expensive way to do things, and while it is somewhat more targeted than just saying we're going to prop up the banking system, it's still a lot of money for an economy that's already looking at possibly a $1 trillion deficit next year.
What's the management question of something like that? I mean, you have to decide which projects to do, which level of government is going to receive the funding, hire contractors. It doesn't seem like it happens that quickly.
Well, one of the nice things is that a lot of these programs that will be funded are actually done at the state and local level. And a lot of state and local governments don't have money to put through infrastructure projects they'd already like to do. They've had to cut back, too, because their budgets are going down. And so identifying projects, especially roads and bridges at the local and state level, won't be that difficult to do. And so it's not as tough to do simply because we have done this type of stimulus program before.
Given the last 8 years of the Republicans in the White House, are the mechanisms still in place for easily transferring large sums of money from the federal government to the states to manage this sort of infrastructure program?
Well, given what we've gone through over the last few months with the sort of massive transfers that the Fed has been able to engineer into the banking system, I think that a lot of us have been pleasantly surprised at the government's ability to actually, you know, sort of spend a hell of a lot of taxpayers' money very quickly.
Yes. Yes, they're good spenders there in Washington. Joining us now is Patty O'Connell, Patrick O'Connell, or Patty, as we like to call him. He's a BBC presenter and host and our frequent guest here on the program. Patty, thanks for joining us.
John, thanks for having me.
They're talking about stimulus packages across the pond over there. What is the outline of the plan that was announced yesterday, and how much of it is taxes and how much of it is direct spending?
Yes. Well, you were waiting for your details tomorrow. We had ours yesterday. Here are the headlines. We're borrowing like we've never borrowed in peacetime before, 1% of our GDP. We're going to spend some of that on motorways, housing and schools like you were just talking about. We're going to cut sales tax. Here we call it value-added tax. You have a statewide, and sometimes I understand some states waive it, but we have a 17.5% sales tax, VAT. That's going to be cut to 15%. Then we're also going to tell the banks and building societies to give hard-pressed homeowners 3 months before going to get them out of their homes. That's how bad things have become. Also, in 2011, we're going to put up the top rate of tax to 45% from 40% for people earning over £150,000. So if I can sum it up, John, it's buy now, pay later. Borrow massively now. It's a gamble. Will it work is the debate we're having here.
Well, it's interesting, Jim Ellis, the Brits and the Europeans largely have a lever that the United States doesn't really have by being able to lower that VAT, which instantly lowers prices across the board for retailers. Do we need a lever like that in this economy, and would it be quicker to just lower taxes in the U.S. as a stimulus?
The danger with lowering taxes here is that so because of the economic stress we also have in the housing market, where lots of people have effectively seen their piggy bank go away, it means that a lot of people might not spend the money. That's what we already saw with the stimulus payments that we had on taxes last year. A lot of people just took that as a way to lower their debt. And one of the things we need right now is to pump more money through the system, not to have people sit on it.
And so money that becomes jobs is more likely to be spent. Money in the form of taxes is more likely to be saved or used to pay down debt.
At least that's been the experience that we had with the first stimulus payment.
Patty, you know, you're used to the Chancellor of the Exchequer over there in Britain managing the economy. Does it seem odd to you to have this enormously large cast of characters in the United States that Barack Obama is trotting out?
No, I mean, I was a Wall Street correspondent in the U.S., and, you know, fans of your country say that the state system and a federal government is one of its strengths. Also, as we know, it can be one of its weaknesses, the pork barrel politics, the who on earth is in charge of this. And if Barack Obama has the right mandate, he can get these people in January and say, I am in charge, and this is what we're going to do. And if enough people will follow him, he can do a stimulus package. That is a separate question from will it work, because it's like the horror film where you're in the car, you're turning the ignition key, and the beast is bearing down. You've got to get that engine started. Everyone agrees. And people have gone back in time to the economists who said, look, if you want to start your economy, drop money from helicopters. That's when you know it's serious. And ultimately, we are looking at the biggest economic change in my lifetime. There's never been anything like this in Britain. Not borrowing on this scale. And this will change our politics.
Patty, I'm at a loss for the movie. There's money dropping from helicopters, and they're trying to start their car, and a monster is coming down the road. The movie just escapes me for a second. Jim Ellis, is there a sense that the economic team of Barack Obama is coalescing, as Patty is suggesting, around a mandate? And if then there is such a mandate, is it coalescing around a particular economic dogma? Is there a person in the administration who looks to be the sort of guru, like Arthur Laffer was on supply-side economics, or Milton Friedman, or Keynes, or any number of economists?
I think because, you know, Obama is walking into a crisis situation, he has a little less time to worry about looking for that economic guru, and he has instead a lot of fires to put out immediately. And so therefore, even though he's the candidate of change, he has looked for continuity in the people that he's chosen for this. I mean, choosing Tim Geithner was a real sort of push to grab someone who's already in the thick of this. I mean, Geithner had been responsible for he was the point man for the Fed in the AIG bailout, in the Lehman thing, the Bear Stearns thing.
Some people say on Lehman, he was the one who said save Lehman.
I mean,
that's the scuttlebutt.
He's a smart guy. He's also, I mean, you know, as Fed presidents go, that is the most important one. Mm. He's the person that they want the continuity there. They've also gone back to Larry Summers at the National Economic Council. Larry Summers was a former Treasury Secretary and is a very smart man.
To both of you, before we go, Patty, do you think it's safe to say that the economic dogma at this point, and it's a little early, looks like save the banks first, worry about Main Street second? That's what's emerging here, Patty, and then Jim?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, they've tried to save the banks. The problem we've got is that the banks won't always be lending that money. They're keeping hold of it. So we've got a small window of opportunity here to stop the economy going down. And there's one piece of information here which I'll give you, which is that our government is predicting that growth starts again within 1 year. And their critics say they're over-optimistic.
All right. Jim, you want to take the last word?
Yeah, I mean, basically, what we've got is the banks have gotten quite a bailout so far and still been unable to lend.
So freeing up the credit, the money to lend, is really the key thing. Jim Ellis, Assistant Managing Editor at Businessweek, and Patty O'Connell, BBC presenter and host from London. Thanks to both of you. And now we're repairing the English language.
I'm calling to complain about the expression to give 110%. You cannot possibly give more than you have. That's called stealing.
877-8-MY-TAKE. Irritating phrases. Come on. Keep them coming.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
On the issue of annoying words, I say enough with the word ado. The one and only phrase I ever hear people using it in is without further ado. But I never hear people saying, and now for some further ado. So if ado is a word to describe something that we're constantly not doing, or at least not admitting to doing, let's just be done with it.
We have some further ado on this subject. In fact, we want you to call us with your most irritating or just wrong words and phrases from the English language that you think should be eliminated or that drive you crazy. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to be discussing that in the next segment, and we also want to hear from you. But today we want to bust some myths about the election, particularly a story that ran right after the election. When Barack Obama was elected, it was reported that gun sales spiked through the roof around the country because people fear that Barack Obama, as one of his first missions in the White House, will be to enact gun control legislation and fundamentally alter the so-called right to bear arms in the Constitution. To discuss that story and the idea of what happens to issues that are talked about a lot during the campaign when once a president gets elected, how they actually are reflected in policy, is Professor Nate Persily, who's the Charles Beekman Professor of Law and Political Science at Columbia University, author of the book Public Opinion and Constitutional Controversy. Professor Persily, thanks so much for joining us here in the studio.
Thanks for having me back.
First of all, let's bust the myth. There were some reports that gun sales spiked. I even saw pictures on CNN of mob scenes in Cabela's, as close as Pennsylvania here. What do you think actually happened?
Well, right now there seems to be a dispute between those who are analyzing the data and those who are watching the mainstream media on this, which is that there's a lot of anecdotal evidence of people running on these gun shops, but that the FBI background checks data does not suggest, at least in the most recent data, that there's been this run on buying guns.
So there might have been some small blip, but it wasn't really sustained and hardly, at least according to the statistics, represents some kind of national tidal wave.
We'll know in a few weeks whether in November, the November statistics are different than the ones in October, but the October statistics don't suggest that there was a run on gun stores.
Now, the issue of gun control was talked about a fair amount during the campaign. What does that suggest in terms of policy initiatives for the new administration?
Well, in the ways that it was talked about was both candidates were running away from gun control, so that you had, for example, I mean, Barack Obama's line about clinging to guns and religion, which he was trying to run away from for about 6 months, led him and the Democrats more generally to walk away from gun control.
Well, let's hear it in Obama's own words here.
The problem is that we've got a position oftentimes by the NRA that says any regulation whatsoever is the camel's nose under the tent. And that, I think, is not where the American people are at. I think we can have reasonable, thoughtful gun control measures that still respect the Second Amendment and people's traditions.
Now, that was Barack Obama speaking back in February. You suggest he's tiptoed away from even that position at this point.
Well, part of it is that there's no incentive on the Democratic side to really regulate guns. And the electoral map is such that the states, for example, like Ohio and Pennsylvania, which have high rates of gun ownership, are ones that are often determinative of presidential elections. And this is something that the Democrats have been slowly running away from or walking away from for the last two, three presidential elections. Even in the Democratic Party platform in 2004, they supported an individual right to own guns, which now the Supreme Court has even reaffirmed.
So the fact that it's a political hot button means that for a president, it's a policy no-no. It's actually political dynamite. It's something to stay away from.
And there's really nothing on the other side, which say there's nothing to balance out the NRA in terms of an interest group that is going to persuade politicians to go in favor of gun regulation. This was not true in the early 90s and sort of the Brady Gun Control Act or the ban on assault weapons was a product of an organized lobby, a sort of public interest lobby to regulate guns. But you just don't see that lobby around anymore.
And that lobby was motivated by crime statistics and also law enforcement that actually actively was in support of these regulations.
That's right. There is a sort of perversity here in that as crime has gone down, the push for increased gun regulation has also gone down.
Right, which would actually make sense. What other so-called wedge issues are the kinds of things that get talked about ad nauseum during the campaign, but once you get into office, they become real pitfalls?
Well, you know, it is often described as guns, gays, and God. So that one other issue that even there's a huge consensus of American people around is, for example, gays in the military. And that over 75% of Americans now say that we should drop the don't ask, don't tell policy, allow gays in, to serve freely and openly in the military. But I don't see any reason to think that Barack Obama is going to follow the same course that Bill Clinton did and deal with that issue in the first 100 days.
Well, in fact, that was a huge error for the Clinton administration, even though the statistics were, as you say, and it was talked about a lot during the campaign, the fact that Clinton attempted by executive order to reverse that policy was enormously controversial and was a giant setback on security issues that dogged Clinton for all 8 years of his presidency.
No, that's right. And I think Barack Obama in particular, because people question his foreign policy credentials and his experience with the military, is less likely to sort of use that as one of the first issues that he's going to be tackling.
And perhaps the page should have been taken from Ronald Reagan, who talked a lot about moral issues during both of his campaigns. But in fact, never did very much. And the conservative Christian movement left feeling as though Ronald Reagan had actually, when push came to shove, not done much for them at all.
Well, where both presidents, President-elect Barack Obama and President Reagan sort of have these influences on socialists is through judicial appointments. And as we've seen recently, for example, with the gun case that went up to the Supreme Court last year, the decisions to appoint certain judges of particular ideological affiliations are the ways that these presidents really have an effect on these social issues.
You're a Columbia professor. What's an annoying phrase in your lexicon?
Mine is "with all due respect," because it never actually means that. It's usually when someone's sort of taking their bat back about to hit you over the head, it's "with all due respect."
Take personally the Charles Beekman Professor of Law and Political Science at Columbia and author of the book Public Opinion and Constitutional Controversy. Thanks for joining us. Headlines now from Femi, okay.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming out to 29 minutes past the hour. The Associated Press just reporting that there is a new government program that will help companies issuing credit cards and making student loans. And also, the Fed has announced purchases of up to $600 billion in mortgage-backed assets to deal with the financial crisis. I'll bring you more details about that story as I get them. And new economic data is expected soon. We should hear a report on the GDP for the third quarter in just a couple of minutes' time. Numbers on consumer confidence are expected later in the morning. The economy is on everybody's minds, President-elect Barack Obama included, and maybe that's why he's holding another press conference on financial matters. He's expected to discuss the federal budget, and yesterday he called for the quick passage of a giant two-year stimulus plan. Osama bin Laden's former driver is being released from Guantanamo Bay. The Pentagon says that Salim Hamdan will serve the remainder of his sentence in his home country, Yemen. Let's look at some of the main stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
The phrase that I can't stand is "no problem." If you say thank you and the person says "no problem," that means they wouldn't do it if there was a problem with it. They should be a little more gracious than that.
Fixing the English language, getting rid of irritating phrases. That's our mission today, and you're a part of it at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. A little news in the last couple of minutes. The markets, the futures trading is jumping for joy over a report that the economy shrank at a 0.5% pace in the summer. That was worse than initially expected or estimated, and the markets are reacting positively. Go figure, but then that's how it often is on Wall Street. In this next segment, we're calling language out of the box. No more business as usual around here. It's a win-win situation and something of a wake-up call for people who want to be most impactful when they are efforting to interface in a one-on-one, face-to-face, mano-a-mano, up-close and personal way. And if you think I'm sounding even more annoying than usual, here's Jeremy Butterfield joining us now from Glasgow, Scotland. He's the author of a new book called Damp Squid, The English Language Laid Bare, which features the most annoying words and phrases in the English language. Welcome, Jeremy.
Good morning to you, John.
I love this idea of damp squid, but I don't want to waste any time on that. How did you compile the most annoying phrases, and who is your judge?
The judge is the public, John, as always, with any language. From various radio shows and websites, I collected the phrases that people reckon are most annoying.
And is the annoyance, does it come from being incorrect grammatically? Does it come from being overused? Does it come from being too corporate and fundamentally dishonest? Describe the nature of the annoyance.
Sure. I think you've hit the nail on the head, excuse the cliche, with those three types. Sometimes it's grammatically wrong, so people get really annoyed when people in Britain, and I guess it's the same in the States, say, I shouldn't have done that.
Okay, that's an incorrect one.
That's an incorrect one. That's a grammatical one.
Impactful would be another one of these grammatical ones, right?
I'm not so sure about that. Really? I mean, I think people also object to new words, you know? Lots of people are very conservative in their language choices. They may not be in their lifestyle and so on. But when it comes to language, I think there's often an innate conservatism because impactful is just a new word. Whether it's necessary or not is a different kind of judgment, in my view.
Can you use nouns as verbs, as people often do? And impact, that's another example. You're using a noun as a verb. Is that a normal way new words get into the English language?
Indeed it is. Think of salting and peppering your food.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, there are two nouns which have historically been translated into verbs. People get really hot under the collar, don't they, about verbing. And I think, you know, in your summary earlier on, you mentioned to interface. That's one I really don't like myself because it's so vague and you don't really know what it means. I might not just say to work with, to talk to communicate with, and so on. There are lots of alternatives. One of the other things you said was, do people just get fed up because these words are overused? And that is certainly one of the reasons people, you know, dislike words and phrases.
You have a category called tired idioms. What are a couple of those?
It's not rocket science.
That's a good one.
I mean, if it isn't, what is, presumably, if it's not the only thing that is rocket science, is rocket science, if you know what I mean. And it's a nightmare. I mean, that's a metaphor, isn't it?
That is the worst.
But, you know, everything's a nightmare. You could, I don't know, you might run out of toothpaste and you say, oh, my God, it's a nightmare. Well, not really. You know, get a grip. It's a fairly minor thing.
Could I run one by you here?
Please do.
What do you think of this phrase? Let's circle back and talk about that, maybe tomorrow.
That's a new one on me, John. Yeah. Let's circle back. What does it mean to you? Can you explain it to me?
I don't know. I get constantly told that we're going to circle back and kind of go over something again, and it drives me completely insane. Here, let me share with you some of our listeners' pet peeves here.
The misuse in our country of the word myself over the last 10 years in particular has always driven me crazy. People use myself instead of me, instead of I. It's really annoying.
So this is a grammatical one. What's the rule on myself?
The grammatical one is that, strictly speaking, you should only use, you can use myself, how can I do this quickly? You can either use it in a reflexive construction, like I wash myself very carefully, or you could use it for emphasis, I did it myself. But I know what your listener's talking about. It's phrases like myself and my wife went to the dinner party.
There you go. Yeah, that's annoying.
So that is technically, grammatically wrong. And I don't know, you've probably noticed it as well with yourself. Can I get some, you know, in a restaurant, somebody might say, can I get something for yourself? Now, why are they saying that instead of you? I think there's a very good reason, which is it sounds politer. You know, to say, can I get something for you could sound a bit abrupt and rude.
All right, here's another one that I want to get your view of here. This one is a pretty standard annoyance.
The word that I can't stand is the word indescribable, because it makes no sense. It means something that cannot be described. However, as soon as you call something indescribable, you have just described it. Therefore, the word is actually meaningless. Things cannot be indescribable.
I don't know if I'd want to be trapped in the same car as that person, but indescribable. I mean, he does have a point there, don't you think?
He's got a point, but I would suggest that this word embodies a paradox. Yes, he's right in saying that you have described it, but what you haven't done is described it in detail. So you're admitting to your failure to describe it adequately, but you're also conveying a very strong impression. So I think it's quite a useful word.
Well, Jeremy, you know, we could go on like this for hours. Let me give you one last one here, and this is one that I do all the time. I get in trouble with this one around the house.
My language terror is the two words put together are commonly misused, and they are sort of. They're overused, and they drive me crazy. Sort of. Sort of this, sort of that. But what is it? Use exact words.
Sorry. It's sort of. It's kind of a disease, isn't it?
It's kind of a well, we've just done it, haven't we? It's sort of a disease. But, you know, lots of language is vague, and we need these hedges, as they're called, to help us communicate. We can't be precise all the time, John. I mean, I know you can be, and I know I can be sometimes, but, you know, it's very tiring, isn't it?
Well, it's a strength of the English language that we can spend all this time talking about the most annoying phrases in it. Your book, Damped Squid, The English Language Laid Bare, is a great list of the most annoying phrases in the English language. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jeremy Butterfield joined us from Glasgow, Scotland. He is the author of Damped Squid, The English Language Laid Bare. Very entertaining. Let's circle back for a moment, shall we?
You doing it, John? This is Russell Bittner calling from Brooklyn. The phrase circle back, if I'm not mistaken, refers to a maneuver that horses and horsemen would have made to circle back around the wagon train to protect from attack. That's as simple as that.
Our listeners are such a resource. They even know the origin of annoying phrases. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. You're full-service linguistic program here at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Adore Udoji is away. You know that phrase, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Well, in another sign the English language is evolving, you can add a new word to your vocabulary, cyberchondria. It's really all about how a little knowledge about healthcare can be a very dangerous thing. It's a term for what happens when you go Googling your health symptoms and end up coming to the worst conclusions and making yourself, well, a little paranoid. In a new survey by Microsoft, who I'm sure don't like us using the word Googling, which is how you find information online, this is on the rise, Googling your symptoms to find out about what you might have. Joining me now to look at why you're as likely to conclude your headache is from a brain tumor as from caffeine withdrawal is Carrie Cooper, who's a professor of psychology and health at Lancaster University in the UK. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, John.
Why is it that when I make a good faith effort using this fabulous tool called the internet and go to learn more about what's going on with my body, I am inclined to come to the most negative conclusion, according to this Microsoft study?
Well, I think really, I happen to be an American originally, and now I'm a UK citizen as well. But I think we have a kind of natural tendency in the US to be hypochondriacs anyway. Americans are kind of very, very obsessed with. You remember the good old Dr. Spock books when you were trying to raise your kid and you were looking for all sorts of symptoms? And I think we're kind of, Americans are particularly symptom driven. And of course, when you go online, you know, you're looking, that there's a lot of novel illnesses and unusual illnesses, and people want to, they put two or three symptoms together and they say, oh my goodness, I've got those symptoms. And they think the worst, don't they? They think they've got this disease that is actually going to cause their death within the next 24 hours. And I think partly it is because there's almost too much online. Not all of it's, by the way, very accurate. And so what we have is a lot of misinformation, and you have little bits and bobs of symptoms, and you don't have the full kind of panoply of things you need to make a decision.
Well, I guess, you know, when I first learned what cancer was, I remember spending years thinking that, well, with all the cells that I have, there must be one that's messing up and is, you know, secretly growing inside of me and turning into a tumor.
Yeah.
How can you change the internet or develop technological tools that will address this propensity to go negative?
Well, I think the important thing is to have evidence-based, isn't it? I mean, it's to have accurate information on the web. That's the difficulty, isn't it? Because you're going to have all sorts of bits of information. How do you know which bits are credible and comprehensive? And I guess the only way really to do it is to do it kind of interactively. I mean, I think a lot of medics have been toying with that idea, haven't they?
So the idea of the internet more as an advisor as opposed to just a giant dump of facts.
Absolutely, where it becomes interactive. So you put in your symptoms, and then it comes back to you and says to you, here's a second iteration of symptoms. Do you have these as well? Go get that checked. And then come back online and tell us what you find with that. And if you did it that way, kind of interactively down the line, you'd probably be far more accurate. But in fact, then probably medicine's going to go that direction anyway.
So rather than just a simple list of potential possibilities, you're actually looking at probabilities arranged hierarchically so that it's more a likelihood that you might have this and an extreme unlikelihood that you would have some other sort of symptom. Carrie Cooper, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Carrie Cooper is professor of psychology and health at Lancaster University. He specializes in stress, and we are talking about cyberchondria, Googling your health symptoms and ruining your day.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We begin with some headlines from Femi. Okay, good morning, Femi.
Hello there to you, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. I'll start this news bulletin with some new economic information. The preliminary American gross domestic product shrank at 0.5% annual rate during the third quarter. The GDP is the largest measure of the overall national economic picture. Final third quarter numbers come out in December. The Federal Reserve says it will buy up to $600 billion worth in mortgage-backed assets in another attempt to deal with the financial crisis. The plan includes buying direct obligations from mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as well as the Federal Home Loan Banks. As he launched a major stimulus package for the UK, Prime Minister Gordon Brown called for global cooperation.
I hope to see a degree of coordinated action with the American administration and with our European partners.
That was the UK Prime Minister speaking on Sky News. The UK stimulus package includes a sales tax cut and new government spending. Leaders of a former Muslim American charity now face life in prison. A court convicted them of funneling donations to the Palestinian militant group Hamas. And at one point, the group called the Holy Land Foundation was the largest Muslim charity in America. And a leading survey is out for cars, and the news is great. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety crash tested the 2009 models, and the number of cars getting the top safety rating more than doubled from last year. And the automaker with the most top-rated cars was Ford, which includes the Volvo brand, and Honda was very close behind. And the insurance companies are thinking of making the test a little more difficult, as so many cars did so well, although it's kind of hypothetical right now, isn't it?
Yes, nobody's buying cars. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So there are complex words, there are obscene words, there are silly words, and then there are words that are just wrong.
The words that bother me is that it's irregardless, which isn't a word, and preventative, which isn't a word. So it's irregardless that we can preventatively stop people from using the words wrong.
Call us with your most irritating words and phrases to be eliminated from the English language at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So it's hard to believe, but 10 years ago, Hugo Chavez became the president of Venezuela. He's been working to increase his influence and profile ever since, some say successfully. The Venezuelan leader is the subject of a new PBS Frontline documentary, which chronicles Chavez's rise to power and how he uses his leadership style to hold on to that power. Here's an excerpt.
How are you, Fidel? Very well. Thank you. And you? Very well.
It is a rare Sunday when Chavez does not mention Fidel in his broadcast. No matter the subject of the day, he calls out to him.
How are you, Fidel? Aquí desde Barinas te saludamos, esta tierra que te quiere mucho. How are you, Fidel?
Why he greets him in English is not clear. But it's obvious that Castro is never too far from his mind.
The Frontline film airs tonight. It's called The Hugo Chavez Show, and it's produced by our partner WGBH in Boston. And we're joined now by Ofra Bikel, who is the producer, writer, and director of The Hugo Chavez Show. Ofra, thanks for joining us. And does Hugo Chavez really think about Fidel Castro as often as that clip from your program indicates?
Oh, he's crazy about Fidel Castro. Totally. I mean, he admires heroes, and he admired Fidel Castro, he admired Che Guevara from when he was a child. And the problem with poor Chavez, that he didn't depose anybody. He wasn't a revolutionary. He just won elections, and he can't get over it. And he loves Castro, just loves him, you know, because he's brave, because he was a revolutionary, because he fought. And
because he confronted the United States so successfully through the Cold War, and that's really become a style of Hugo Chavez's entire presidency. Has he been able to remake himself as a revolutionary while in power?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, not really. He talks about it. First of all, I mean, he's very different than Castro. I mean, Chavez never killed anybody. Chavez doesn't imprison people. On the whole, you know, the elite did not leave the country. Some did, but not in the way that the Cubans did. So no, he's not like Castro, and he would love to be like Castro, but he's not.
But the Chavez story is very much a story of wealth. The oil wealth that Venezuela commands, and much of which is sold to the United States, is the reason why Chavez is able to remain in power. We had elections this week, which sort of showed an erosion, but also continued to show his popularity inside Venezuela.
That's right. I mean, he is popular. He fought for this election incredibly hard.
And he wasn't running.
He wasn't running. Yeah. No, it doesn't matter to him. I mean, he pretended he was running. It was all new governors, and he fought in every state as if he was the governor. I mean, yeah, there was an erosion. It is interesting that he lost Caracas. He lost the mayoralty of Caracas, and he lost the biggest shanty town, the biggest shanty town in Latin America. In other words, the poor.
Right.
And I don't know what he will make of that.
And that's his strength, really, because he is talking about being a champion of the poor and turning the oil wealth of Venezuela into an engine for social change. But here's what one individual from your documentary made of that policy.
It's only a matter of speeches. Big speeches, nothing happens. You know why? Because Venezuela is selling about 1.5 million barrels per day of crude and products to the United States. Most of the crude oil which goes to the United States is heavy crude. That heavy crude is processed in some special refineries in the United States, and that crude cannot go to other places. Then Chavez cannot cut the supplies to the United States. If Chavez cuts the supplies to the United States, he will remain in power a few weeks.
That's former Venezuelan energy minister Humberto Berti saying that the confrontational rhetoric against the United States is empty because Hugo Chavez can't cut oil supplies. And he says that the whole social policy is a matter of speeches only. Is that what you found?
I found that there might be good intentions, but there's no follow through. I mean, he doesn't have a government. That's the problem with Hugo Chavez. He has yes men. And so the ideas must be very worthy and very interesting, but nobody follows through. And the ideas are also sort of naive in a way. I mean, he was sort of thought that he was going to give people money and he was going to take people who are unemployed, give them money, they will go to classes, and then they will open cooperatives, and then they will make money, and then there will be an engine of change. But people went to the classes, took the money, and left. One thing, and just didn't do anything, or they would establish cooperative, but they didn't. But they knew nothing about marketing or about, and so things just completely collapsed.
Although the criticism of a lack of follow through is not something that would be confined to the government of Venezuela, you can see that in governments all around the world. So I'm wondering if the idea of this, colorful, candid character who can't keep his mouth shut, who has his own broadcast, the two-hour television broadcast that is literally the Hugo Chavez show.
2 hour? Eight hour.
8 hours, right. I mean, is there something about him that is more honest as a politician than maybe the more buttoned-up dictator types that we're used to in this region?
I think so. I think he's honest. I think whatever, I mean, when he's happy, he tells people. When he's angry, he does. When he scolds his minister, it's right on the air. He's honest. I don't know. You know, he's very honest. He's completely the opposite of Obama, you know? I mean, Obama is not thinking about how to do and how to have people around him. Chavez doesn't need anybody around him. He doesn't want anybody around him. He's very happy by himself. And you just call him and say, just say, yes, Mr. President, and he's very happy.
Is he threatened by oil prices declining?
He says no. He says no. I mean, he has like 200, reserved for 200 years. So he says that he's not, and for the moment he isn't.
Well, it's a fascinating character study tonight on Frontline. Ofra Bikel is the producer, writer, and director of the Frontline documentary, The Hugo Chavez Show, and it'll be on the air from our partner WGBH in Boston and on PBS stations around the country. Ofra, thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
So we're continuing to collect annoying words, and we want to hear what gets your goat. Apparently some of you have some opinions.
An expression I hate is quite unique. Something is either unique or it isn't.
It's not rocket science.
One phrase I've never understood and I really don't want to hear ever again is up close and personal. What does that mean?
I'm tired of people saying to a group of people, which might include me, you guys.
Mine is with all due respect, because it never actually means that. It's usually that when someone's sort of taking their bat back about to hit you over the head, it's with all due respect.
There's some phrase you want to hit with a stick. Come on, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
If you want to start your economy, drop money from helicopters. That's when you know it's serious.
It's our friend, BBC presenter Paddy O'Connell. He knows his stimulus package. We're always on at The Takeaway. Our podcast is waiting for you. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
How are you, Fidel?
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Oh my God, it's a nightmare.
Okay, robots, if you're going to hang out with us humans, there are going to be a few rules.
You just can't go around killing people.
Why?
What do you mean, why? Because you can't.
Why?
Because you just can't, okay? Trust me on this.
Teaching ethics to robots is not just something for screenplays. It's a real technological question. In a world of robot soldiers, are we closer to Judgment Day? Hasta la vista, baby. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, November 25th. Adora Udoji is away, and we're going to examine the unusual presidential transition that we're in, plus presidential pardon power. It's absolute. And we'll tell you what criminals want President Bush to give them a break before he turns in the keys to the White House. It's called a pardon. Those stories and more coming up. First, some headlines. Fresh economic data just out a few minutes ago. The American economy shrunk 0.5% in the third quarter. That drop in the gross domestic product is even worse than analysts expected, but the markets are reacting positively. Futures are way up. It looks like a busy, positive opening on Wall Street. It's a busy morning for the Treasury and Federal Reserve. The Fed just announced it will buy up to $600 billion in troubled mortgage-backed securities. It announced a new acronym you can get used to practicing on, Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, the TALF. The government will lay out tens of billions of dollars to help companies giving out these loans. And President-elect Barack Obama will step forward to give more details on his financial plans and his team. Yesterday, he introduced a new Treasury secretary, a slate of financial advisors. He's pitching a costly stimulus package, which means chopping federal spending.
To make the investments we need, we'll have to scour our federal budget line by line and make meaningful cuts and sacrifices as well.
I'm going to practice this new acronym, and Femi Okeh has the rest of the headlines. Hey, Fem.
Hi there to you, John. President Bush says that he's working with President-elect Obama on some major economic moves.
I told the American people, and I told the President-elect when I first met him, that any time we were to make a big decision during this transition, he will be informed.
President-elect Obama takes over the White House on January the 20th. Now, investors apparently appreciate all of the economic moves. Futures trading points to a higher opening on Wall Street, and that happens in just a few minutes' time, and this after big gains yesterday and Friday. Osama bin Laden's former driver will move from Guantanamo Bay to his home country of Yemen. The U.S. military decided to transfer Salim Hamdan to finish his sentence there. He was accused of serious terrorist crimes, but a military jury judged him a low-ranking al-Qaeda aide. Hamdan spent 7 years at Guantanamo.
And he gets to go home to Yemen. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So we're talking about, we're actually collecting annoying words and phrases from the English language.
The word I hate the most is awesome. Everything is awesome. Oh, it's so awesome.
You should come on over to my house. My four kids love the word awesome. But we want you to call us with the most irritating words and phrases that you think should be eliminated from the English language. How would you eliminate them? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Why? Just trust me on this. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Arnold.
What do you mean, why? Because you can't.
Why?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Let's get real. Did it feel yesterday a little bit like White House transition gridlock, or was it more like a presidential two-for-one sale?
I told the American people, and I told the president-elect when I first met him, that any time we were to make a big decision during this transition, he will be informed.
We need to restore both confidence in the markets and restore confidence of middle-class families who find themselves working harder, earning less, and falling further and further behind.
Yesterday, both the president-elect, Barack Obama, and the sitting president, President George W. Bush, faced the American people to talk about economic policy and to explain that they were in each other's loop, and we're certainly happy to hear about that. It was also unveiled the senior members of the Barack Obama economic policy team, who will apparently be getting started making policy before the inauguration. Joining us now to discuss what it looks like to see these two dueling presidents in a single day in a country where we're only supposed to have one president at a time, at least that's what I was told by the president-elect, is Jim Warren, former managing editor of the Chicago Tribune, commentator for MSNBC, and a columnist for the Huffington Post. He's on the line from Chicago. Jim, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure to be in your loop.
Yes,
Don.
Indeed. I will always inform you of any major decision that I make. What do you make of this kind of dual presidency business that's going on right now? It is a little unprecedented, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I'm looking at four newspapers that show up at my doorstep on the north side of Chicago, about a mile north of Wrigley Field. And on every single one, the only images there are of either of those guys is of Barack Obama. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Chicago Sun-Times, Chicago Tribune. Not a single image of President Bush. And when I, you know, was prowling the internet yesterday afternoon to look at their coverage of the two respective announcements or comments on the economy that both guys made, there was virtually nothing on the president. So, I mean, it's almost as if, you know, you're at a play and, you know, you look at your playbill and, one of the acts has just disappeared. And now you're in, the final act. And everything is fast-forwarding with the attention so obviously on Obama. I mean, the images were just very, very vivid yesterday of him surrounded by his team in a sense that these are the guys who will now confront this economic mess. And there you had the president, you know, on the steps of the Treasury with, a few people around him, an ever-earnest Treasury secretary who did strike me as sort of looking like the big, broad-shouldered gym teacher who's been promoted to school principal.
Right. Well, it was interesting, and it's not just guys that were surrounding Barack Obama. There were at least two women on his economic team that he announced yesterday. I mean, it did feel a little bit like you're at a high school, musical, and suddenly Paul McCartney is subbing for the lead. Barack Obama has this sort of outsized personality and profile right now. But do you actually think that in the White House machinations there is a kind of unprecedented, we haven't really seen this before, sort of crisis management by both White House teams?
Well, I mean, I think they're lucky because quite naturally that guy Geithner, the new Treasury Secretary, I think whether he had been picked by Obama or not, he was going to be involved in a lot of these discussions as head of the New York Fed, which he remains. So you're going to have some overlap regardless. And I do think, once you point out, that there have been precedents for distinctly lame duck presidents whose poll ratings have been in the total tank. I mean, after Reagan creamed Jimmy Carter, Jimmy Carter was going through that Iranian hostage crisis with, Bush-like approval ratings. And he was not only able to sort of pull off a deal finally, but he was also, people forget, able to get through the Congress a couple of really, really significant environmental measures, I think, in late November and then December of that year. But, yeah, I mean, I think there's a little something going on. But, if I'm Bush, the first call I'm not making every day is not out to Hyde Park in Chicago to Barack Obama, because I think he's a guy who's pretty self-confident, verging on the arrogant. And, he's the guy now until January 20th still.
Right, and Chicago feels a little bit like Crawford, Texas these days with the sort of camp out there of the transition team. It would appear that in this lame duck moment, though, President Bush is probably spending as much time thinking about his pardons and his sort of end game here in the last weeks of his presidency than anything else. And some of those pardons were announced yesterday. Joining the conversation is Eric Lichtblau, who's a New York Times correspondent who reported on the pardons that were announced yesterday. He's on the line from Washington. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
What do we make of the names that were announced yesterday? And I want to get Jim Warren's impression of, because pardons are really presidential theater in the last days of an
sure.
administration. Eric, go ahead.
The story was really about the lack of any big names. There were 14 pardons and two commuted sentences. None of them were high-profile people. These were sort of garden-variety crimes for the most part, drug distribution. There were a couple of unauthorized uses of fertilizers. None of the big names that people have been speculating about. Marion Jones, the Olympic sprinter. Michael Milken, the financier. Duke Cunningham, the convicted congressman, none of those were on the list. And I think it's safe to say, I mean, of course, we have another 2 months before Bush is out of office, that Bush, who has been very sparing in his use of pardons over the last 8 years, is going to end his term that way with no real bangs a la Bill Clinton, who, of course, went out of office with yet another political scandal on his hands by pardoning Mark Rich, the fugitive financier, and his own brother.
But how much of a legacy is it to have staked your claim on the bringing justice to the unauthorized use of fertilizer crisis?
Yeah, you know, I can't imagine Bush likes to talk a lot about his legacy and how he'll be remembered in 50 or 100 years. I can't imagine that he's really thinking about his pardons being a part of that legacy. I think he just assumed that no one be talking about his pardons, and he's doing a pretty good job with that.
And
although if I might add, guys, I'd love to hear Eric. It's interesting that one pardon coming from the Clinton administration, Eric just mentioned, that of the fugitive businessman Mark Rich, could somehow be the one that most people talk about if, in fact, Eric Holder, who was a key member of the Clinton Justice Department, ends up being nominated for attorney general. And even though it was something that I was immersed in back at the time, and it was quite the scandal, it wasn't until I was really reminded about it the other day in an op-ed by a former Washington Post investigative reporter, George Lardner Jr., who made the case that if you look at go back and look at the specifics, you know, Eric Holder was, you know, intimately involved in a arguably very, very dubious act, and a guy who was also represented by by then former White House counsel, a guy named
Jack Quinn,
who has been close to the Obamas.
Well, it's interesting. In the Holder confirmation, it will be a Clinton pardon that's talked about, not a Bush pardon. How did these names, do you think, how did they even get into the mix? Is this some sort of correcting errors in justice kind of good deed process that the Bush administration has going here?
Well, there's a long-standing process that dates back many, many presidential administrations for petition clemency requests to be made. Anyone who's been either convicted and out of prison or currently serving a sentence can petition the president for use of his constitutional pardon power. And we're at now historic levels in the number of petitions. I think it's currently at about 2,300 from high-profile people like Michael Milken, who I mentioned, to the bulk of them being no names that no one had ever heard of. And there's a whole process that goes through the Justice Department. There's a pardon office. The ones that the Justice Department thinks are worthy of some leniency, they're in their current prison time or having their records pardoned and having certain rights restored, are then forwarded to the White House, to come back to Mark Rich, as we always seem to do in this context. The problem with Eric Holder, who is expected to be named as Attorney General, is that the White House did not go through that normal pardon process.
Right.
They
again,
sort of skipped through the whole thing. As far as we know, all the pardons that Bush has done, again, I caution, as far as we know, did go through that normal process with the vetting and recommendations of the Justice Department.
And the process is just voluntary. I mean, the Constitution grants the president complete, total power of pardoning. I notice here, looking through the names, that a backup singer to Carly Simon pardoned for aiding and abetting in the distribution of cocaine. So interesting.
That was the closest we came
to celebrity. Right.
The closest we came to celebrity was Carly Simon's backup singer.
To both of you guys, what's your most annoying phrase in the English language, really quickly? Eric?
Most annoying phrase in the English language.
Okay, he doesn't have one. New York Times style book, man. You guys are trained really well. Eric Lichtenbaum, New York Times correspondent, thanks for joining us. Jim Warren, Out of the Loop is yours, former managing editor of the Chicago Tribune. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Jack.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We are just storming through the dictionary and the English language, just getting rid of annoying phrases. We're going to share a bunch with you later on in the program. But at this very moment, technology teeters seriously on the brink of actually being able to create autonomous robot soldiers for real battlefields. Of course, we can probably get robots to shoot straight. That's not much of a technological challenge. But can we get them to actually follow something like the Geneva Convention on the battlefield or conduct an interrogation of a prisoner of war? Or could we at least prevent a scenario like this from coming to pass?
The system goes online on August 4th, 1997. Human decisions are removed from strategic defense. Skynet begins to learn at a geometric rate. It becomes self-aware at 2:14 a.m. Eastern Time, August 29th. In a panic, they try to pull the plug.
Pull the plug, for heaven's sakes. That, of course, is from Terminator 2, Judgment Day. It's all about how robot soldiers and robot computers actually ended the world or came close. Joining us now to talk about whether we even want robot soldiers to begin with and what are the ethical questions of training them to work with humans is Cornelia Dean. She has a piece on the front page of the Science Times in today's New York Times about ethical robots. Cornelia, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
So what are the challenges of teaching robots who we're pretty confident can shoot straight and probably faster than humans to make ethical decisions on the battlefield?
Well, I think the first challenge is to decide whether you want to make machines to make these decisions in the first place. And that's the most important issue, I think, that the researchers that I spoke to were talking about. And that is, this kind of thing can be done, probably. Maybe it can be done. But the question is this a road as a society we want to go down in the first place? And they are urging a wider public discussion about what, you know, is this even acceptable?
And we're already pretty far down this road. I mean, there are non-autonomous robot devices that are used on the battlefield almost routinely today. What is the state of technology on autonomous robots?
Well, there are all kinds of things that can be done, and there's all kinds of research going on all over the place for useful things. For example, you know, robots that will vacuum your house, or people are working on robots that can assist disabled people or elderly people to stay in their homes. There are all kinds of useful technologies that have been developed or are being developed. But what these researchers say, which I think is true, is that if you're doing, no matter what kind of work you're doing, if you're working on robotics, in a way, you're working for the military because the military is sweeping the scientific literature. And if they discover something that's useful for them, they'll pick it up, as well they should.
So the ability of a vacuum cleaning robot in your home to make an ethical decision about maybe not disturbing someone in the room who's watching television as they work is appropriate on the battlefield in making moral decisions on deciding who to shoot at or...
Well, I don't know whether the vacuum cleaner cares whether there's anybody in the room or not, but the question of under what circumstances is it ethical to fire a lethal weapon, that's what some of these people are looking at now, whether it's possible to build that capacity into a robot, or if you can't do it perfectly, if you can do it better than if you can cause a robot to make those decisions better than people can.
And what would constitute better? I mean, it seems to me if you've already decided that the robots will be the soldiers, you've really made the decision that there's a whole different moral set of values that governs robot soldiers versus human soldiers.
Well, I think that's one of the issues that these researchers wish that members of that all of us in society would talk about. But one researcher that I wrote about, what he says is that we already know that people on the battlefield are prey to a number of factors that reduce their capacity to act ethically. They may be angry. They may be stressed out. They may be looking for vengeance. They may be exhausted. They may have all kinds of problems that reduce their ability to do the right thing. And a machine, in theory, can be built without these problems.
Where is this research taking place, principally, in robotics vis-a-vis, ethical behavior and trying to teach complex behaviors to robots?
Well, the research that I focused on is going on at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, in the robotics lab of Dr. Ronald C. Arkin, who's a computer scientist and roboticist at Georgia Tech. But people all over are talking about it, including Dr. Arkin. Dr. Arkin is a real passionate advocate of bringing this issue to the fore, to having some kind of a discussion about it. And he's been at conferences and so on. The issue is kind of rising in the scholarly community, and they are organizing conferences and meetings and publications and so on about it. But he and other people, Dr. Arkin and other people involved in this, want to move it into the wider public arena.
Does the Pentagon want to proceed with autonomous robots without getting the public involved in a broader ethical discussion of what that would mean?
Well, what the people in the Pentagon, when I spoke to them, what they say is, we're interested in scientific research that's relevant to us, but decisions about what kinds of systems will be deployed and when they'll be deployed and so on are the province of the civilian control of the military, which we have in this country, and up to the commander in chief.
So it's a reiteration, a sort of technological version of civilian control of the military.
Yeah, and what one of them said to me is, the commander in chief is answerable to the public, and so are we answerable to the public.
Cornelia Dean, thanks so much for joining us. Cornelia Dean is the science reporter for the New York Times. Her story on ethical robots is on the front page of the Science Times in today's paper. And there's more about the ethics of war robots on our website, thetakeaway.org. And now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Wall Street is ready to go. Right now, the Dow Industrial Futures are heading in an upwards direction. And that's despite some rough financial news in this morning. The economy shrank 0.5% in the third quarter, and that's worse than analysts expected. Housing numbers are out as well. Home prices dropped by the sharpest annual rate on record in the third quarter. They're down more than 16% from this time last year. New York Senator Chuck Schumer is stepping down as head of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. His party won at least 13 Senate seats under his chairmanship. New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez is expected to be named the new leader today. A Texas court has convicted five leaders of a large Muslim American charity of supporting terrorism. The Holy Land Foundation was once the largest Muslim charity in the U.S. Its members are accused of sending millions to the Palestinian group Hamas. The leaders have denied the charges. They say they were involved in legitimate humanitarian aid for community welfare programs. And two young Indians have been signed to play baseball for the Pittsburgh Pirates. It's the first time Indian nationals have been recruited to play the sport professionally. Baseball isn't played in India, and the two 20-year-olds have never thrown a baseball before last year. Javelin throwing was their sport. Maybe that's why the Pirates believe they'd be good pitchers. And they came to light after winning India's $1 million armed competition, a contest for throwing balls at high speeds. Well, good luck to them. And that's a look at some of your stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The markets are open. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has jumped about 100 points. The S&P is up about 12. That's approaching 2%. More later. Well, obviously, positive reaction to economic news this morning. You know, I've been speaking English all my life, and it turns out the language could use some improvement.
My first words of the English language are, as my grandfather used to say, whatchamacallit, and my grandmother used to say, forget about it.
What are your most annoying phrases that you'd like eliminated from the language? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're cleaning up English for all the world here on The Takeaway. So as recently as a year ago, it would be almost impossible to imagine a story about a vote set to take place this week in the Iraqi parliament to reauthorize the U.S. military presence in that country, that it would just get lost in the massive electoral and economic headlines. But that's the case. Very important vote is scheduled to take place this week. BBC's correspondent in Baghdad, Humphrey Hawksley, talked to us earlier about this. Humphrey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, first of all, this is the agreement that the Bush administration spent practically a year negotiating with the Iraqi government. It's called the Status of Forces Agreement. It basically allows the U.S. to continue its occupation. There was celebration on the streets of Baghdad when this agreement was announced in anticipation of the vote. But what are the controversial provisions at this point?
Well, I've just came back a couple of minutes ago. I was actually in the Iraqi parliament talking to the parliamentarians that are going to be voting on this. Basically, it's thought that most Iraqis want the vote to go through. That is that the U.S. withdraws all its troops by the end of 2011 and it gets off the streets by the middle of next year. But there's a lot of horse trading going on that's going to go on past midnight, probably right up to when the vote takes place, because the parties on either side of the mainstream want to bring in their own conditions for it. On the Shia side, the Shia Mahdi army, the extremist side there, they want clerics to have more of a say in what goes on in Iraqi politics. On the Sunni side, they say they want the representation of the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police force more represented by the Sunnis.
And is the violence that we've seen this week, the really serious uptick in violence in Baghdad, connected to this vote?
That is almost impossible to say, John. I mean, I've been covering this story for many years, and there will be a big political development happening like this one. There will be violence or no violence. It's almost impossible to connect them. But what we have seen is we've seen a lowering of the insurgency, but for sure the war has not ended. We don't know whether it's an insurgency on its last legs, and those carrying out these bombings can be brought into a political process, or whether everybody is just simmering and waiting for things to happen, rearming, getting their energy back for a bigger war that might break out later.
We shall see. Until that happens, it appears as though the Maliki government has played their cards pretty astutely here. It would seem to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, Humphrey, that the Bush administration pretty much has to accept this agreement regardless of the details that might be thrown in at the last minute.
Well, I think it does now, particularly because you've got the presidential transition in the U.S., and it's seen by everybody to be a good agreement. It gives 3 years to get it right, and in that 3 years, a lot could happen, but essentially it gives the process that's going on that started, say, with the surge, everybody that I talk to wants that to continue. And if you have a sudden withdrawal of the troops like the Shia extremists want, or if you want to change the sort of the modalities that are on at the moment, that could disrupt things even more. So I think that everybody wants to stick with the dates and the deadlines here. But what's not known is whether the vote will go through because of the conditions that are being asked by various political groups.
Political cliffhanger in Baghdad, Humphrey Hawksley, thanks so much for joining us. He spoke with us from Baghdad about the impending vote in the Iraqi parliament that will approve and formally reauthorize the Status of Forces Agreement that allows U.S. troops to remain in the nation of Iraq. And now headlines from Femi Okay.
Thanks, John. The time is coming up to 24 minutes to the top of the hour. Just looking at the TV screen, checking what the Dow is doing right now. Open for business, up about 100 points or so. Osama bin Laden's former driver is being released from Guantanamo Bay. The Pentagon says that Salim Hamdan will serve the remainder of his sentence in his home country of Yemen. He was convicted in August of aiding al-Qaeda, but he spent 7 years on Guantanamo Bay. President Bush pardoned 14 people yesterday and shortened prison sentences for two others. The president hasn't granted many pardons despite receiving over 2,000 requests. Those seeking clemency include two politicians convicted on corruption charges and former junk bomb salesperson Mike Milken. President Bush also met yesterday with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. They both promised to leave behind a productive peace process to their successors. This was probably the last meeting for the two lame duck leaders while they remain in office. Now, as he launched a major stimulus package for the UK, Prime Minister Gordon Brown called for global cooperation.
I hope to see a degree of coordinated action with the American administration and with our European partners.
That was Prime Minister Gordon Brown on an interview with Sky News. The UK stimulus package includes a sales tax cut and new government spending. Somali pirates have hijacked a Yemeni cargo ship in the Gulf of Aden. Polish captain Marek Niszki spoke to our partners at the BBC earlier today about conditions on the ship.
I would say it's not a reason for complaints. We were given already opportunity to talk to the families. As you can realize, these are the most important things for us now.
39 ships have been attacked off the coast of Somalia so far this year. One maritime group has suggested a blockade around Somalia. NATO says that's unlikely to happen. If you're flying to Bangkok today, you probably won't get there. All international flights have been cancelled as anti-government protesters storm into the airport. They want to keep the Thai government from meeting there. The Thai Prime Minister moved there after protesters forced him from his main offices in August. They're a very determined bunch. Yesterday, they stopped Parliament from a meeting.
Determined bunch? I mean, this has been going on since the summer.
Months.
Months and
There's
months.
There's an instalment almost every day. I only bring you the really exciting ones.
Well, thank you, family. They are very, very exciting.
Yeah.
What's your view of the word awesome, by the way?
It's used a lot.
Too much? Is it irritating?
Save it for special occasions.
Save it for special occasions.
Yeah.
Who uses it for special occasions? Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So the English language, it turns out, needs a lot of improvement.
The word that's used too much is the word wicked. And the only thing that I can think of is the Wicked Witch of the East in The Wizard of Oz. That's an appropriate use of the word wicked.
All right. Suggestions and anomalous annoyances in the English language. Here's another one.
My name is Andy Hammerstein, and I'm responding to the most annoying word or phrase question that was asked a few seconds back. And my least favorite expression is, at the end of the day. It so cuts off conversation.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I'm Ben in Brooklyn. I want to completely and utterly remove the word guesstimate. It doesn't add anything. Guess is just as good. Estimate is just as good, and it just is so cutesy.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And consider this, folks, a wake-up call, all right? I mean, languages aren't perfect. They're kind of like song lyrics. There's really annoying language in the English language that needs to be fixed, and that's why we asked you to give us some suggestions. Let's fix the imprecision of English.
I find a phrase I hear, thanks for having me. Do they mean on toast in bed? I'm getting tired of hearing it.
My language, terror, sort of. They're overused and they drive me crazy. Sort of. Sort of this, sort of that. But what is it? Use exact words.
I'm calling to complain about the expression to give 110%. You cannot possibly give more than you have. That's called spewing.
Well, it's sort of like phrases that are depressing.
The misuse in our country of the word myself over the last 10 years in particular has always driven me crazy. People use myself instead of me, instead of I. It's really annoying.
There are two grammatical errors that drive me crazy, and I hear it in radio, film, TV all the time. Nobody can conjugate to lay and to lie anymore. They say he was laying on the floor, I was laying in bed instead of lying. It drives me nuts.
Do, 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 to da, da, da. You know, when you just can't find the word that you need, and so you stumble on something that's just plain wrong.
The phrase that I hate is, to be honest with you. Because obviously if somebody says that, they are not normally honest. So why say anything?
The phrase that is absolutely driving me crazy, in which I beg you guys to at least use properly, is begs the question. Begs the question doesn't mean, hey, that raises the question. What a good idea to think about that and ask. No, it means that you are beggaring the question, i.e., you're talking all around it, but you're not going to answer it.
I'm actually getting a little worried. I mean, maybe the English language is full of holes and is sinking. Maybe what we're into here is a giant linguistic Titanic.
My name is Missy, and I'm calling from the road in New Jersey. I'm on my way into work in Patterson, where I teach. I hate it when people use nouns as verbs, like How will that impact this situation? Drives me crazy.
But of course, then there are words that are just grammatically incorrect, that actually violate the rules, that are an affront to the language on their face of it.
All I ever hear is it's going to get worse before it gets better. Just once before I die, I want to hear somebody say it's going to get better before it gets worse.
If I never heard the phrase throwing them under the bus again, it would be too soon. There's got to be some more poetic Shakespearean way to describe betraying somebody or doing wrong onto another.
But forget meaning. What about pronunciation?
Two words in that I loathe and despise. The mispronunciation of nuclear as nuclear, and the mispronunciation of supposedly as supposably.
The one that absolutely drives me crazy is presentative.
So how are we feeling now? Are we improving our language? Are we making it better? We called 877-8-MY-TAKE. We took the initiative. We saw the flaws in English, and we went right to the problem.
I hate oftentimes. All you have to say is often. It adds nothing. It's redundant, and it sounds stupid.
Let's fix our language, shall we? Going forward, that is.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The big economic story out this morning, the Federal Reserve just announced it will buy up $600 billion in troubled mortgage-backed securities. Also, some key economic information out this hour as well. The American economy shrunk 0.5% in the third quarter. This drop in the GDP is worse than analysts expected. The Humane Society is taking six major retailers and fashion designers to court for falsely labelling clothes. The lawsuit claims that real fur was deliberately labelled fake fur. Pierre Grubowski from the Humane Society says that customers can be duped because the fake fur can be more expensive than the real stuff.
Real fur, if it's of poor quality, can actually be less expensive than a good quality faux fur, which some of the good quality faux fur is now indistinguishable almost from real animal fur.
And the Humane Society says that they were forced to act after retailers refused to voluntarily change their labels. Thirsty astronauts can now celebrate. After days of forced starts, a water purifying machine finally works for Shuttle Endeavour astronauts. They're installing it at the International Space Station. It failed earlier tests, and it's important to get it right because it makes water from bodily fluids, so you really want to be sure it's working before you take a big swig. Hope you're enjoying your breakfast. And finally, Judge George Sacco has come up with a novel idea to punish people who disturb the peace. The judge from Fort Lupton in Colorado is punishing noise violators by sentencing them to an hour of Barry Manilow music turned up extra loud. Here's the judge explaining the unusual punishment.
What is really hard to listen to is music that is generationally extinct from the listener. So if you have a young kid who's 18 or 20 years old, music from 20 years ago, they're not going to like it.
So George Sacco says...
So the 80s is like a punishment?
Depends how old you are.
I see. Yeah. Nice, yeah.
Yeah, depends how old you are. George Sacco says the punishment has cut down on the number of repeat offenders in Colorado. And this is one of the tunes that the news team has been rocking out to this morning.
Poor Barry Manilow.
Yeah.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Together now, we fix the English language.
The phrase that drives me mad crazy is what I often hear my students say when they're finding the location of another person by adding another word, as in saying, "Where are you at?" And I tell them it's unnecessary, and then I ask them if they had dinner, supper last night, or if they drove in their car, automobile. It drives me crazy, insane.
It's perhaps a bit more of a crisis than the English language subject we've been exploring at 877-8-MY-TAKE this morning. But we're now going to turn to John Cassidy, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He profiled Ben Bernanke, the chief of the Federal Reserve, in his article Anatomy from a Meltdown. And, of course, the meltdown we're beginning to have some historical perspective on. And, John Cassidy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me on, John.
There's a lot to talk about here, and let's just begin with Ben Bernanke is an academic whose academic background is studying the Great Depression. And yet in the story of Anatomy of a Meltdown, it seems that he was behind the curve on almost every important milestone going into this crisis, including the 100-year drop on the Dow Jones Industrial Average that happened in early October. Why do you think?
Well, I mean, it's been a pretty remarkable crisis from start to finish, hasn't it? And I think it just took him quite a while to get up to speed. He was quite optimistic about the American economy going back as far as 2007. And he just didn't realize, as did most people, the scale of the crisis when these subprime loans started getting into trouble. The basic problem in understanding it was that they're only a very small part of the economy relative to other debts. And he and other people at the Federal Reserve assumed that it would be a pretty small-scale problem that they could deal with. They knew there were some issues and that some banks might get into trouble, but they never dreamed it would get to the scale that it's got to.
Describe, and you go into some detail in your article in The New Yorker, about the decision to let Lehman Brothers fail, but to save Bear Stearns, and then subsequently to save AIG. Looking back now, that was a pretty controversial decision.
Right. Well, most people agree that that was a big mistake now, letting Lehman Brothers go, because the day that it went under, the financial crisis escalated enormously and spread to a lot of other markets. Things seemed to have been calming down a bit during the summer, and the Federal Reserve seemed to have a handle on things. But then they made this decision to let Lehman Brothers go under, which was contrary to what they did in the Bear Stearns case. There's still a lot of controversy as to why they did that. But almost everybody now agrees, including people at the Fed and even Bernanke himself, that, you know, that has had a major effect on the markets and helped to spark what was basically a collapse in the financial system in September and October.
Now, the historians look back on the Great Depression and conclude with a pretty good unanimity or consensus that a failure to deal with the banking system early on prolonged the depression, and that would be an academic issue that Bernanke would know very, very well. Does that inform his decision-making now, and do you think he believes he's been a good manager here?
Well, I think he thinks he's done as well as he could under the circumstances. And certainly his work on the Great Depression did inform his decision. Once he realized the scale of the crisis, the Fed has been very aggressive, propping up institutions. We see just yesterday in the Citigroup case, you know, he was involved in that. And now there's going to be another announcement today of another big fund in which the Fed is going to buy assets from troubled banks to replace the TARP, which has been abandoned, obviously. But it's still a bit of a mystery, as you said, why Bernanke didn't get it earlier, because his work on the Great Depression did show that banking problems were one of the big reasons why the Great Depression lasted so long. So if just based on his academic record, one might assume that he would have got this very early on and acted quicker. I wasn't able to really completely resolve that crisis. As I say, the main defense of Bernanke is that he wasn't alone. Most other people at the Fed and the Treasury and indeed on Wall Street didn't realize the scale of the problem either.
On the other side, do you see Bernanke being drawn into a domain of federal intervention into markets that is fundamentally at odds with his sort of economic dogma, his sort of doctrine that he is known to follow from his published papers? I mean, is he being forced to do things that he probably would have flunked students for doing in class, that kind of thing?
Well, I don't know about flunking students, but I mean, that's the main theme of my piece, is how this quite conservative chap who was basically a pretty mainstream economist, which means he supported free markets, has been forced into the biggest extension of the Federal Reserve's authority in 100 years. And how he would defend it, I think he would say, is that, look, in normal times, free market policies work well and we should stick with them, limited government, etc. But in a financial crisis, all the old rules go out the window, and the only institution which can restore order and prevent a wholesale panic is the government. And what's happened is he's basically turned the Federal Reserve into a sort of lender of last resort, or a pawnbroker, if you like, for the entire financial system.
Well, that's the takeaway from your article that I get that's so fascinating. I mean, perhaps it's all about really the definition of an economic crisis. The definition itself is that the rules go out the window, that you've reached a point where there are no analogs from the past.
No, exactly. I mean, it really is dealing with, you're dealing with, it's like an avalanche, if you think about it. How do you deal with an avalanche? You know, they deal with one rock slide and they think the thing has been solved, and then another one develops a few days later. I mean, I spoke to Bernanke early last week and he seemed relatively confident that they had a handle on things and the worst was over. And then literally 2 days later, Citigroup, you know, second biggest bank in the country, almost went under. So it's a remarkable situation, and he's doing his best, but, you know, they're having to improvise every day.
So you talked with him before the Citibank thing. Did you call him back and say a couple questions about Citibank, Ben, and he hasn't gotten back to you yet?
Actually, the Citibank thing happened just after my article finished. I just managed to get the various outlines of it in.
Well, I tell you, you'd want to be a sort of a 24/7 fly on the wall in this crisis. John Cassidy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
John Cassidy, staff writer for The New Yorker, who profiled Ben Bernanke in his most recent article, Anatomy of a Meltdown. And just crossing the wires, former NFL quarterback Michael Vick for the Atlanta Falcons pleads guilty this morning to state dogfighting charges in an apparent bid to speed possible return to the NFL. That's just crossing the wires. Perhaps more on that in the morning. So we are talking about annoying words and phrases from the English language, and boy, do we get some.
I'm French originally. One of my pet peeve sayings is when people say, oh, it has a certain je ne sais quoi.
Not for nothing. I hate when people use the word snuck, as in I snuck into the room, rather than sweet. Snuck is not a word.
Staycation.
The most annoying phrase is, please hold while I connect you to a live person.
If you want to hit an English phrase with a stick, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. There are tons more of your suggestions for improving the English language on our website at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
It becomes self-aware at 2:14 a.m. Eastern Time.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Why?
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.